Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The death in detention of Turkish human rights lawyer Ebru Timtik is an utter waste of a human life, UN-appointed independent rights experts have said. Ms. Timtik died on the 27th of August after 3 years in detention and a hunger strike lasting 238 days. She was arrested with other lawyers in September 2017 and sentenced to 13 years and 6 months in prison after being charged with belonging to a terrorist organization. In a joint statement, the experts said that Ms. Timtik's death was entirely preventable before calling for an investigation and for Turkey to release other rights defenders. They highlighted allegations of unlawful detention and unfair trial and restrictions on the freedom of expression and regretted that little was done to prevent this tragic outcome, despite the engagement of the Turkish authorities. Almost 100,000 children in Beirut have been affected by the massive explosion a month ago in the city's harbour area. UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, said that one in two children that it has been helping has displayed signs of psychological trauma, from bedwetting to aggressive behaviour and withdrawing from parents and friends. The agency's priority is to help 25,000 youngsters over the next 3 months in child-friendly spaces with more specialised and longer-term support for the many thousands who need it. Here's UNICEF Protection Officer Rula Abisad.
You know, the explosion happens mainly in their own homes. Like, this is where usually this is the safest place for the children, supposedly. So with the explosion, they lost the safety. So within the child-friendly spaces, we try to establish back the routine and like a sense of normalcy for those children in their life. Like, they would come to the center to, sometimes it's just for playing. It doesn't always need to be with a clear objective. It's just to give the opportunity for the child to be a child.
UNICEF has appealed for around $47 million to provide emergency support to affected families and children in the coming months. This includes repairing basic essential services, such as mains water, and providing protective equipment against COVID-19. To hear the full UN News interview with UNICEF's Rula Abisad, just go to our audio hub on our website or your smartphone. Fallout from the coronavirus pandemic will push 47 million more women into poverty, reversing decades of progress in tackling the problem. A new report, released on Wednesday by UN Women and the UN Development Programme, UNDP, points to a 9.1% increase in the poverty rate for women this year. Prior to COVID-19, the rate was expected to decrease by 2.7% between 2019 and 2021. Extreme poverty is defined as having to live on $1.90 a day. The projections also show that women will be affected far more than men by the end of next year. For every 100 men aged 25 to 34 living in extreme poverty, there will be 118 women. Worryingly, this gap is expected to increase by 2030. By 2021, the total number of women and girls living in extreme poverty is expected to reach 435 million, with projections showing that this number will not revert to pre-pandemic levels until 2030. Nearly 6 in 10 of the world's poorest women live in sub-Saharan Africa, while there are fears that South Asia could also experience a resurgence in extreme poverty despite recent gains in poverty reduction. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Nathan Fuller, the head of the newly formed Committee to Defend Julian Assange and Civil Liberties. Assange's extradition hearing is coming up on September 7th. A lot's at stake here. The First Amendment and the right to free journalism. Listen in. We'll also speak with Leslie Williams in Chicago. She's a member of Jewish Voice for Peace and one of the people that worked on a pamphlet exposing the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, as an organization which is not an ally of the civil rights movement.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Last week, the state of Michigan announced a $600 million preliminary settlement in civil cases filed by Flint residents arising from the contamination of their drinking water with toxic lead. Ben Crump, one of the nation's top civil rights attorneys, was one of the lawyers representing many of those residents. He spoke at two rallies about the water crisis in Flint 8 months ago. Let's take a listen to what he had to say then.
The terrible thing about environmental injustice is the fact that, unlike some of the other cases I've represented, whether it's Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown, this environmental injustice is different because it has a subtle way of killing you, and it has an impact that happens generational. And even though many people say, well, we don't see the effect today, that does not mean it's not going to have a profound impact on your child's life, because they deserve competent representation and fair compensation over this injustice that never should have happened.
That was Attorney Ben Crump. Anyone who lived in Flint between 2014 and 2016 is eligible to apply to the Victim Compensation Fund. Flint City Councilman Eric Mays says the compensation money is, quote, primarily going to the kids who've claimed in state and federal lawsuits that they were poisoned by city water while state-appointed emergency managers were running the city. Children are especially vulnerable to lead poisoning. Infants and children under 5 years of age can experience brain damage before their brains are fully developed. One local newscaster broke down how the settlement funds will be allocated.
Most of the money will go towards settling claims filed on behalf of children in Flint. The settlement breaks down like this. After attorney fees and expenses, children in Flint who were exposed will get 79.5% of the money. 64% of that money will go especially to children under 5. Adults and property owners will get 18% of the payout, and businesses will get 5%. And finally, 2% will go to programmatic relief. Today, attorneys on the case say it's a step closer to justice, adding that the deal was aimed at helping the most vulnerable.
Listeners will recall that Flint is a majority African-American city, where over 40% of the residents live in poverty. In 2014, Flint switched its water supply away from Detroit's system, which comes from Lake Huron, and began relying on water from the Flint River. The city was in a financial state of emergency, and the switch was intended to save the city millions of dollars. But the river water proved to be more corrosive than Lake Huron's water, and it wasn't treated properly. Because of that, it caused lead, which is a powerful neurotoxin, to leach from the pipes. Residents began noticing their tap water sometimes came out blue or yellow, and many people developed rashes on their faces and arms, while others began to lose their hair. Despite this, local officials and leaders denied that anything was wrong for over a year, even as residents complained that the water tasted and looked strange. The city has since switched back to using Detroit's water system, but many local residents still use bottled water for drinking, cooking, and washing, saying that they no longer have trust in their local government. Thousands of residents, in total, filed lawsuits against the state of Michigan, and this recent preliminary settlement would only resolve claims against the state, not against individuals, including people like Rick Snyder, who was governor at the time, or claims against private companies. Michigan's total budget hovers around $58 billion, but much of that is federal money or is earmarked for other purposes. The state currently faces a budget shortfall due to revenue decline from the coronavirus pandemic. So it's unclear at this point where the $600 million settlement funds will come from.
President Obama prosecuted and imprisoned more whistleblowers than any other president. But Trump did one thing that Obama did not do. He indicted Julian Assange, the publisher of WikiLeaks, for conspiracy under the Espionage Act, charging that in 2010, Assange and his publishing organization, WikiLeaks, released truthful information about American war crimes. Obama had held off making such a charge because the U.S. government has never before gone after a publisher, not even the New York Times, for publishing the Pentagon Papers. Assange sits in solitary confinement in the notorious Belmarsh prison in London. He awaits the outcome of the USA's extradition request. His partner, Stella Morris, the mother of their two young children, said, quote, Julian is being targeted by the United States administration for the crime of journalism. He helped expose the war crimes and human rights abuses, which the U.S. would have preferred to keep hidden from public view. He revealed the killing of unarmed civilians and the torture of innocent people. No one has ever been held responsible for these serious crimes that Julian has exposed. The extradition aims to entomb and silence him forever, end quote. He's in bad shape mentally and physically. Nels Melzer, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, visited Julian and reported that he has been tortured by the months on end of solitary confinement. He hasn't seen his lawyer in 5 months, and he's seen his wife only once in the last 5 months. He hasn't seen his children. He can't prepare his defense. He was finally given a computer, but the keys were glued down. When he last appeared in court, he could barely pronounce his name. What's at stake is the future of free journalism. Journalists have a right to publish, and we, their audience, have a right to learn. That is what the U.S. government is attempting to take away. We speak today with Nathan Fuller, the American head of the London-based Courage Foundation and the director of the newly formed American Committee to Defend Julian Assange and Civil Liberties. Nathan Fuller, welcome to Law and Disorder. I should say welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate you having me on.
Nathan, it was alarming to read that people close to the situation who are supporting Julian Assange think that the British prison authorities, in conjunction with the United States, are hoping that Julian dies in prison or even commits suicide. Did you read that report?
I've heard people suggest that, and unfortunately, that would be their easiest way out of this problem with this extradition trial going on for a long time and gaining a lot of opposition around the world.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, the former head of the CIA, called WikiLeaks non-state intelligence service, and Hillary Clinton has suggested that they drone him. Why is Julian so hated?
Yeah, so I think this is fairly straightforward, actually. I mean, with these people, he published evidence of their direct wrongdoing, their criminality. While Secretary Clinton was Secretary of State, he published evidence of war crimes carried out by the military under her administration. And with Pompeo, he published evidence of the CIA's hacking tools. He's exposed their wrongdoing at the highest level, and this is not something that usually happens to them. They're usually allowed to carry out these activities in secret, and they usually get away with it. And this is finally a challenge to that, and this is their revenge. The way they're carrying out revenge is, of course, extremely dangerous for Assange, but the way they're doing it is in a way that's dangerous for the rest of us, too. Direct attack on the First Amendment, attacking publishing more broadly. But with Assange in particular, he's the one who took the risk, knowing that this kind of situation was potentially coming, to publish it anyway because it was in the public interest and giving us citizens a window into what our government's doing, you know, in secret behind our backs.
Well, his partner, Stella Morris, said that they've successfully entombed him. How long has he been in solitary in Belmarsh prison? And before that, how many years was he holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy?
Yeah, so he was in the embassy from 2012 till 2019. The Ecuadorian government, a newly right-wing government, revoked his asylum and allowed the British police into the embassy to come in and arrest him and take him out of there. So he was in there for nearly eight years, I believe. And then so that's almost a year and a half now that he's been in Belmarsh, a maximum security prison known as the Guantanamo of London. So it's been almost a year and a half there, and he's been in solitary confinement, as we understand it, for most of that time. It's difficult to get exact details because visits are sporadic, and we can only really hear when somebody has visited him and is able to pass that on. But he was visited in May 2019 by UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Nils Melzer, And Melzer concluded that Assange had suffered psychological torture, and that was not enough to change his prison conditions. His health mentally and physically has been deteriorating, as of course it would, being in arbitrary detention for nearly 8 years and then being in prison and solitary confinement for more than a year now. And so it's really concerning. And doctors, more than 60 doctors signed an open letter calling for him to get urgent medical care. And he's really not getting the attention that he needs.
Well, he's got a frozen shoulder. He recently injured his ankle. Is he able to see a doctor, or does he just have to sit with that condition and that kind of pain?
He's not able to get any kind of outside medical care. He was at one point spent some time in the medical ward, but obviously that was not adequate medical care. And this idea of medical care has come up in other extradition trials. The Courage Foundation was big backers of Lori Love's campaign against extradition to the U.S., and the prison conditions here were a big factor in that, and realizing that you would not get adequate medical care or psychiatric care in the U.S. prison. And so Assange is already dealing with that and facing the prospect of a much worse situation to come.
And the COVID epidemic has spread not just in American prisons, but at Belmarsh prison as well, hasn't it?
It has. It's incredibly difficult for prisoners to be able to protect themselves. And so this is just a horrendous situation made far worse. COVID has already killed fellow inmates at Belmarsh. The UK has been compelled to release some prisoners, nonviolent, low-level offenders, but they keep having these prison release policies with carve-outs that just happen to exclude Julian Assange. So he's applied for bail, you know, hoping for a home confinement, you know, not trying to escape, but just basic home confinement, and that was rejected. And later in 2019, more than 60 doctors signed an open letter expressing extreme concern over Assange's medical condition and the fact that he needs urgent medical care, and that has been denied or ignored in the year and a half since. So coronavirus, of course, has only made all this situation far worse. It essentially puts all prisoners in effectively in solitary confinement, and it prevents them from being able to protect themselves. Fellow inmates at Belmarsh have already been killed by the coronavirus. It's spreading around British prisons rapidly, and he has not been allowed to have a mask until Stella visited him last week.
We're speaking with Nathan Fuller of the Courage Foundation and the newly formed committee here in the United States to support Julian Assange and civil liberties. What are Julian's lawyers trying to do to get him out? What's he charged with, and what is the defense that's being raised?
Sure. So he faces extradition from the UK to the U.S., and if sent to the U.S., he has been served an indictment of 18 counts. One of them is for conspiracy to commit computer charge, and the other 17 are under the Espionage Act. And so those total a potential sentence of up to 175 years in prison. These are the first Espionage Act charges for a publisher for just pure publication of documents. They also include for obtaining documents and conspiring to obtain documents. And these are activities that journalists do every day. So it's really incredibly worrisome for journalism, for the First Amendment, and then for our right to know. So his lawyers are trying to bring this aspect up in court to show that this is journalism, that the U.S. government wants to paint him as a hacker, as somebody bent on taking down America, as somebody who's nefarious and trying to use publishing to achieve his hacking goals. But that's far from the truth. And so the defense lawyers are countering that narrative, showing that he has heavily redacted documents to protect sources, that this is real journalism, that this is activity that other journalists carry out all the time.
The strategy of the United States was also to smear him, and they got the Swedish government to go along with it. He was hinted that he was some kind of sexual violator, although there was never any allegations against him. And then they got the Ecuadorian government. They helped overthrow the Ecuadorian government And Correa was thrown out. He was a progressive who granted asylum to Julian. And they got a new president in who took away the asylum. What does the lawyers for Julian say about him being a political prisoner and that all the allegations in the indictment against him violate the First Amendment?
Yeah, so this is, as you have laid out a bit here, it's a concerted effort among multiple governments to keep him in detention and then to smear his character. It was later revealed that UK prosecutors actually persuaded Swedish prosecutors to keep their investigation open into his sexual assault allegations in Sweden. That case was eventually dropped, but it's really telling that the UK found it useful for them to encourage Sweden to keep it open, interfering in the Swedish justice process in a way that's really damaging, and in a way that's obviously serves their own goals. And so, as you note, the Ecuadorian government, Rafael Correa, wanted him, gave him asylum, granted him citizenship, and the right-wing government, now headed by Lenin Moreno, received a multi-billion-dollar loan from the IMF, and in exchange, essentially, they turned over Assange, revoked his asylum, and let British police in to arrest him. And now he's only being held for U.S. extradition warrant. So it's kind of a common misconception that he's being held for violating British crimes or Swedish ones or otherwise, but he served a short bail sentence and now is only being held for this U.S. extradition request and this indictment that, as you say, threatens the First Amendment. All of this activity is protected journalist activity, or should be, and this is the first most grave challenge to it in our country's history.
Nathan Fuller, what kind of support network does Julian Assange have in the United States?
So we're working to grow that. We have this, as you mentioned, this new committee to defend Julian Assange, Civil Liberties, has chapters in major cities around the country. And as I think you've alluded to, he has support networks in countries around the world, Australia and UK and America among them. And petitions for his release of various forms combined for hundreds of thousands of signatures, if not more. And so there's real support around the world. It's just those politicians in power who've been exposed who want to see him punished.
Who are the honorary chairpersons of the American committee?
Yeah, we have Noam Chomsky, Alice Walker, Dan Ellsberg as our co-chairs. And stay tuned for some events and other announcements coming up. We have, check out Courage Found on Twitter, or look at defend.wikileaks.org right now for some upcoming announcements on that. But yeah, very excited to have all three of those participating and lending their support. Dan Ellsberg, of course, was the whistleblower behind the Pentagon Papers. And in his case, the government wanted to go after the publication, but were not ultimately successful. And instead just went after the whistleblower. Of course, that case fell through as well, but there are really interesting parallels here.
Tell us, what do you believe is at stake here if we lose?
As we've talked about, the First Amendment is definitely under attack here, as the New York Times, the Guardian, Washington Post, and the New Yorker have all written. This is a real attack on activities that they undertake all the time. And that in turn means that our right to know is at risk. We protect journalists not just because they should have the right to publish, but because to know that their investigative journalism provides us a window and able to hold our own governments accountable and hold them transparent. And that's just essential. But this is also the U.S. government attempting to prosecute a foreign journalist. He's an Australian citizen operating in Europe who's not in America at the time of these allegations, and saying that they should get to dictate what gets published about it around the world. So not just saying American citizens can't violate the Espionage Act, anyone around the world. And so they say the First Amendment doesn't apply, but the Espionage Act does around the world. So it's really dangerous in various aspects.
For publishing the truth, it's plenty scary. Nathan, remind us again how people can learn more about the Julian Assange defense.
Sure. So this Courage has this campaign site at defend.wikileaks.org. Check out our previous extradition coverage. We have a live blog, timelines, resources, and how you can get involved. Follow us on Twitter at CourageFound. And stay tuned. We have several exciting announcements coming up and more on that U.S. committee to defend Julian Assange.
Nathan Fuller, before I have to say goodbye to you, do you have any final thoughts?
Just want everyone to be aware that this is coming up. September 7th for 3 weeks is this extradition trial. So look out for those for our website and Twitter for trial coverage and how you can get involved from here. It's taking place in London, but it's because the U.S. government has the extradition request. You know, the U.S. government could block this request, could drop the indictment, and it's just a matter of enough public pressure to make that happen. So we need to make our voices heard.
Are you going to be going over for the hearing?
I'm still figuring that out. It's a difficult situation with the quarantine and COVID, but I will be covering it in one capacity or another. Absolutely.
I pledge to you, Law and Disorder will be covering it too, and we'll get back in touch with you, Nathan Fuller. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder and for your good work.
Sounds great. Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The Anti-Defamation League pretends to be a civil rights organization, but the ADL is not an ally. It has a legacy of supporting racist policing, surveillance, colonialism, and the silencing of social justice activism. It has branded itself as a civil rights organization in ways that conceal and legitimize its right-wing activities, undermine the rights of Black, immigrant, queer, Muslim, and Arabs. In August of 2020, 100 organizations signed an open letter exposing the ADL. Among the signatories are organizations whose work Law and Disorder has covered on this radio program. These organizations include the Center for Constitutional Rights, the National Lawyers Guild, and Palestine Legal. These 100 organizations signed an open letter announcing the publication of a pamphlet written by a working group with contributions from the American Friends Service Committee, Jewish Voice for Peace, and Palestine Legal. We speak today with Leslie Williams. She's a member of the Coordinating Committee for Jewish Voice for Peace in Chicago, the advisory board of the Speakers Bureau for Jews Against Anti-Muslim Racism, and a founding member of Zadik Chicago, a non-Zionist pro-social justice synagogue in Chicago. She's the author of The Anti-Defamation League Kills the Black Jewish Alliance and We Can't Fight Anti-Semitism and Anti-Black Racism in Isolation. She works with a local coalition of teachers and activists to bring Palestinian history into schools' curricula. Leslie Williams, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Michael. Really pleased to be here.
Leslie, talk about the ADL's long history of surveillance of social justice movements, please.
Their primary goal has always been supporting the state of Israel and protecting the state of Israel from any kind of criticism. And I think that goes a long way to explaining their history of surveillance and their history of attacks against people of color and progressive organizing. So back as far as the 1930s, the Anti-Defamation League actually worked as a private spy agency for the United States government. They reported to the House Un-American Activities Committee and to the FBI. They spied on a number of progressive movements. And in 1993, there was a lawsuit against them which found that they had operatives in seven different communities, and they spied on many organizations that were considered or that they considered extremist. And their definition of extremism is very interesting because although they were examining some white supremacist organizations, they were spying on and collecting data on members and leadership of Greenpeace, the NAACP, the United Farm Workers, ACT UP, Artists Against Apartheid, the Asian Law Caucus, and especially the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, which is really one of the leading Arab equivalents to, say, the ACLU in terms of focusing on discrimination against Arab Americans. They also spied on members of Congress, including Nancy Pelosi. And this was something that was kind of an open secret in the progressive community for a very long time. They also had extremely disturbing connections to the apartheid regime in South Africa. And in fact, by 1986, the relationship between Israel and South Africa was so close that the ADL was regularly giving confidential information to the South African Bureau of State Security. So, this idea that their primary mission is to protect civil rights is really kind of hard to defend when you look at their history.
Well, I'll say they spied on two organizations which I've been active in, the National Lawyers Guild and the Center for Constitutional Rights. But one of the disturbing things, I think, is their relationship with various police departments across the United States. They train the police. They support racist militarizing of the police force. And I wanted to ask you about what they do with the various police departments in the United States and how they send them over to Israel for training.
Sure. The ADL has had a long relationship with policing and with the military. So around the anniversary of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, the local St. Louis Police Department chief received an award from a local organization for their innovative training that increased law enforcement's understanding of their role as protectors of the American people and the Constitution. And the director of that organization said that Black people who were, quote unquote, impacted by the police simply needed to engage more and remember that it was the police who were actually getting shot in the street. And the organization that did that was the Anti-Defamation League. So you have the Anti-Defamation League in St. Louis telling Black people who are being killed by the police that it's really the police who are in danger and that they simply need to engage more. And I think that incident really tells you everything you need to know about the Anti-Defamation League and their association with policing. So the training that this police chief got an award for was the Anti-Defamation League's training. They actually brag of being the largest non-governmental provider in the United States of law enforcement training on hate crimes, extremism, and terrorism. And every year they give customized in-depth training to over 10,000 federal, state, local law enforcement officers. And as you mentioned, a large part of that training is taking them to Israel to learn counterterrorism training and surveillance training. Because of this connection, Jewish Voice for Peace, which is the major organization that I am active with, has developed a campaign called the Deadly Exchange, which looks at how many police departments and also how many ICE agents are involved in these police trainings. And it's clear that this does have an effect. Some of the people that have been given awards by the ADL included Ray Kelly from the New York Police Department, who introduced the stop and frisk policing. And this was after an ADL-sponsored police exchange program to Israel, where he decided to help implement a program modeled in part on how Israeli authorities operate in the West Bank. So you see a really direct connection there between racist militarized policing in Israel and Palestine and racist militarized policing in the United States. Another ADL awardee is Commissioner William Bratton, who is behind the broken windows policing in New York. And he, too, modeled his racial profiling on what he learned in Israel. So there is a very direct connection. And it's also interesting that the ADL is just absolutely in love with police and military and the FBI. They've given awards not only to police departments, but they've given their awards to former directors of the CIA, a former Secretary of Defense, former U.S. Homeland Security directors, and a former CIA director. They also have as director of their programming someone who was once with the Department of Homeland Security. So it's very clear that they see policing and militarization as part of their mission. And I just want to read another extremely amusing thing I found on the ADL website. They do a lot of advice to synagogues, but also to other houses of worship of how to keep themselves secure and safe. And so they published a pamphlet in 2017 for churches and synagogues on how to, and it advised them to have really strong relationships with the police. And if your local police has a special weapons and tactics team, in other words, a SWAT team, you should invite SWAT to map your institution and property to determine what information would be helpful in the event a SWAT team is deployed. And if appropriate, consider volunteering your site, that is your church or synagogue. Volunteer your site to serve as a location for SWAT or bomb squad training. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion right now about, you know, defunding the police and also about how synagogues and churches, many of them are in African-American neighborhoods or they have African-American staff. What does that say to an African-American neighbor or employee of a church or synagogue if you're inviting SWAT teams in to do practices in that community? There's a document out called Not Free to Desist, which many Jewish communities have signed on to, that specifically addresses this constant militarization and policing of synagogues and the fact that you can rarely go to a synagogue in the United States without seeing intense security around it and what that means in terms of relationships with the Black community. And you would think that a civil rights organization would have some sensitivity to that as opposed to encouraging synagogues and churches to involve more and more law enforcement and SWAT teams in their buildings.
What does the ADL do to repress Palestinian rights and smear critics of Israeli colonialism as anti-Semitic?
Well, this is also something that has been part of their mission statement for a long time. I think it's really interesting to look at the ADL's website and see what they spend the most real estate on. And although it is in their mission statement that they fight anti-Semitism and other bigotry, as though anti-Semitism is separate from all other sorts of bigotry, the other thing that they mention is standing up for Israel. And this is all over their website. We stand up for Israel. We protect Israel. And what they have managed to do is come up with a definition of anti-Semitism that equates opposing any form of Zionism, opposing the idea of Israel as the Jewish homeland, as being anti-Semitic. And this is something that several other organizations have had a hand in. There's something that is known variously as the European Working Definition on Anti-Semitism or the International Holocaust Remembrance Association, which was originally drafted as a way to evaluate if there was growing anti-Semitism in various communities, but not as an actual standard of anti-Semitism. But the State Department adopted this in 2016, and the ADL was one of several pro-Israel organizations that pushed that to happen. And that definition includes several points that specifically equate criticizing Israel or criticizing Israel as a Jewish state as being anti-Semitic. So it includes denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination and claiming that the existence of the state of Israel is a racist endeavor or applying double standards of Israel. So, for example, anyone who questions the fact of a state to be for a particular nationality or ethnicity when talking about Israel can be accused of anti-Semitism. And of course, if you're Palestinian and you believe that that land belongs equally or primarily to Palestinians, that Palestinians also should have equal rights in that area, then you would not accept this idea that Israel should be primarily a Jewish state. And so by using this definition, the Anti-Defamation League is making it very difficult for Palestinian organizers, particularly on campus, to operate. The Anti-Defamation League has pushed colleges to accept this definition, and we have seen many, many, many attempts to sue college organizations for holding Israel apartheid programs, for example. Several schools such as Harvard and Tufts and the California schools have experienced complaints from the Anti-Defamation League about their Israel programs. The VP for International Affairs for the Anti-Defamation League gave a speech at the U.S. Commission on Religious Freedom saying that that definition should be used to provide educational guidance for law enforcement, teachers, and community leaders. So this means that if you're a Palestinian student organization, if you're Students for Justice for Peace, for example, it is very difficult to hold programs on campus without the risk of being accused of being anti-Semitic. And for example, in 2011, the Anti-Defamation League wrote to Stanford and claimed that student debate about divestment from Israel created a divisive environment that bred anti-Semitism. And in 2015, they urged student government members to bar the student body on campuses from voting on divestment referendums, saying they were simplistic and one-sided. And they also often bring up this idea of programs being one-sided or needing balance. And yet, I don't recall the Anti-Defamation League ever questioning an Israeli program or a Hillel program on campus for being one-sided and not balanced in its programming. But it's always Palestinian programs that are accused of being one-sided.
We're speaking with Leslie Williams. Leslie was part of a working group that wrote an open letter announcing the publication of a pamphlet on the ADL. Leslie, how can people get a hold of this pamphlet? I've read it. It's 30 pages long. It's really, really good and something that we've wanted to see produced for a long time, and it's finally out. How can people get a hold of this pamphlet?
Very easily. Just go to the website dropTheADL.org.
Great. Talk to us about what the ADL has done to support Islamophobia, please.
Yeah. Now, this is something that Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, gets very sensitive about because, of course, when Trump announced the possibility of a Muslim registry, Greenblatt made a very showy statement about how the minute there was a Muslim registry, he as a Jew was going to be the very first person to sign on to the Muslim registry. So, you know, that sounds all very well and good, but it's kind of difficult to say that you oppose Islamophobia when you consistently refuse to work with Muslim organizations. So we already talked about the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, which the ADL actually spied on. The primary Muslim organization that is working on Islamophobia right now is the Council of American Islamic Relations, and the ADL refuses to work with them. And in fact, they have a quote backgrounder about them on their website that lists them as being virulently anti-Israel and hints, really does more than hint, that CARE is anti-Semitic. And the director of their Center on Extremism simply says, we do not see CARE as an organization we are willing to work with. So how can you say that you're opposing Islamophobia if you won't work with Muslim groups that are working on Islamophobia? In addition to that, they have a pattern both with Islamic groups as well as African-American groups of saying that they support civil rights of Black people and civil rights of Muslims, but the ADL has to decide which Muslim leaders and which Black leaders they are going to support. And a really great example of that is Keith Ellison, who's a U.S. representative from Minnesota. So he's African-American and Muslim. He was the first American Muslim elected to Congress. He was had made a bid to head the Democratic National Committee, but the Anti-Defamation League was one of several, once again, pro-Israel organizations that claimed he was anti-Semitic because of comments he made talking about how much influence Israeli politics has in U.S. politics. The context of that speech was that he was speaking to American Muslims, encouraging them to as much influence in politics as pro-Israel people in the United States were. But Greenblatt said that Ellison's remarks raised concerns over whether he could represent the Democratic Party's traditional support for a strong and secure Israel. So clearly, supporting a Muslim congressman was less important to Greenblatt than that this Muslim congressman support a strong and secure Israel. This is typical of the Anti-Defamation League. So, you know, in 2006, not only have they spoken out and attacked Muslims, but they have given money to anti-Muslim organizations. So in 2006, the ADL Foundation made a donation to the Middle East Forum headed by Daniel Pipes. And Daniel Pipes, as people don't know, is one of the leaders in this clash of civilization theory. And he's done a lot of extremely Islamophobic writing. He was appointed by the Bush administration to help craft their Middle East policy. And he is considered by many organizations to be one of the people who's really done the most to sow Islamophobic imagery and themes into American politics. So on the one hand, Jonathan Greenblatt is talking about, oh, you know, he can't wait to sign on to the Muslim registry to show how down he is with Muslims, when his organization is actually supporting the person who has created a lot of this Islamophobia in the first place. You know, the ADL, in addition to giving awards to police and FBI agents, they've given a lot of awards and a lot of attention to anti-Muslim conspiracy theorists. And in 2010, the ADL worked with Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer, who were both notorious Islamophobes, opposing the construction of a Muslim community center in downtown New York because it was too close to Ground Zero, and that it was an insult to the memory of September 11th. And they have also aligned themselves with Daniel Pipes and other bigots with anti-Muslim campaigns against Debbie Almentasser, who was the principal of New York City's Khalil Gibran International Academy. They've attacked the CARE director in Los Angeles and called him an anti-Semite. So how can you say that you're truly opposing Islamophobia when you are working, supporting, giving money to Islamophobes and attacking Muslim leaders? And of course, you know, we've seen something similar recently with the attacks on Ilhan Omar for her supposed anti-Semitism. So I feel that their claims to be supporters of the Muslim community are very hypocritical.
Leslie Williams, we're unfortunately running out of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you as a second to the last question, because my last question is going to be, how can people get a hold of this excellent primer or pamphlet that you've been part of producing? But tell us about, what do you think the implications are of the ADL's activities?
So the major implications, and as I said, people have to recognize that their primary goal is really supporting Israel, not supporting civil rights. And what that means is that anyone in the progressive world that in any way violates their concept of anti-Semitism and their determination for supporting Israel is going to be deemed anti-Semitic and is going to be, they are going to attempt to tar and feather that person. And that is even happening with people in the liberal Zionist community. So recently, Peter Beinart, a journalist who has always been a very strong Israel supporter, he came out with a statement saying that he really was beginning to think that the two-state solution would not work and that a binational Israel with equal rights for Arabs and Israelis was the way to go. And the deputy director of the ADL said that he is playing into the hands of anti-Semites by doing that. So that just shows you that their definition of anti-Semitism is completely meaningless. It simply means anyone who does not hold their line on Israel. And on the other hand, they have supported anti-Semites who were in support of Israel. So, for example, they gave awards to Rupert Murdoch and Silvio Berlusconi, and they have supported Trump's attempt to move, or not an attempt, but they've supported Trump's move of the embassy of Israel to Jerusalem, even though some of the speakers there were rabidly anti-Semitic pastors. So what this means is when they do their so-called good work, they have figured out that a good way to get support for their Israel policies is to be seen as partners on civil rights and partners on human rights endeavors. So they will partner with as many progressive groups as they can, as long as those groups don't push their Israel criticism too far. And this is an actual strategy that they have entered into recently. And we see that with the opposition to the possibility of Israel annexing the West Bank. They will support moderate, toothless, over-concerned about it organizations, but any organization that actually calls for conditioning aid to Israel, that organization is anti-Semitic. So when progressive organizations work with the Anti-Defamation League, what we feel is that they are giving cover to all of this really extremely reactionary anti-civil liberties work that the ADL does, which is why we're calling on progressive organizations, LGBTQ groups, immigrant rights groups, African American groups, to really think long and hard on whether working with the ADL is worth having their movements really be hijacked by an organization that is really very anti-civil rights and is really simply pro-Israel.
Leslie, my last question before I have to say goodbye is, how can listeners follow your work, and how can they get the pamphlet that you've just come out with?
So the primer that we wrote is called The ADL is Not an Ally, and really all you have to do is go to the website droptheadl.org, and you will see all the issues that I talked about, including references and citations, and the list of 200 different civil rights organizations and faith communities across the country that have signed on to our primer.
Leslie Williams, thank you very much for this informative interview, and I appreciate deeply your work, and thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to be here.
Take it easy.
All right. Bye-bye.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof. 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF-FM, 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM, 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio, 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI, 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida. KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio. Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut.
WJFF Radio Catskill, 90.5 FM. WDRT, 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU, 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine. 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine. Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD, 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE, 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI, 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento, 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
You dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS LPFM 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM.
WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE, 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI, 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO, 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT, 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, online community radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS, 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KBOO, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA, 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD, 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA, 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR, 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC, 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU, 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI, 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ, 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI, 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our Streaming Planet podcast. WPFW, 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT, 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL-FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont, Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG, 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL, 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP, 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD, 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP, 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRN-LP, 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC, 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYR-LP, 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Workforce Rising Online. KBFG 107.3, Seattle, Washington, and KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
And we'd like to extend a special thanks to KNSG 89.1 FM in San Diego, as well as KGHI 99.1 FM in Westport, Washington.
WMNB LP 107.1 FM, North Adams, Massachusetts.
KODX LP 96.9 FM, Seattle, Washington.
KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
KBFG 107.3 FM, Seattle, Washington.
WEJPLP 107.1 FM, Wheeling, West Virginia.
That's on Mondays at 7 a.m. and Friday at 7 p.m. And finally, the Progressive Radio Network on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. If you're not on this list and would like to be, please contact lawanddisorder.org, our producer Jeff Brady, so we can count you among our growing list of stations, and we'll notify you of upcoming programs and specials. Thank you.